Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. We're going to talk with Pennsylvania State Representative Scott Perry from the 92nd Legislative District here in Pennsylvania about his English-only bill, House Bill 888, where we're going to make Pennsylvania an English-only state. And the wonders of open welcome arms, what that's going to mean, why he's doing this, what the point is. That'll be an interesting conversation. Also, we're going to talk with Dustin Slaughter, activist, filmmaker from the Philadelphia area. Currently, he is in New York at the Wall Street protests. Saturday was the day of rage. Some 5,000 people came out to protest Wall Street and really the greed class. I mean, you cannot possibly look at what's going on Wall Street and say that's the way you want to run an economy, where the people who are making billions of dollars are paying less taxes than the people who are cleaning the floors. A problem there. Now, the right, they'll argue, well, you know, the guy cleaning the floors, he should be paying less taxes. And they go, well, you know, if you make that argument, who is then going to provide for schools and military and roads and bridges and do all the things that we need, that we know we need to do? And we're going to talk about transportation today, too, because getting out of New York City was an absolute nightmare. And anybody who tells me that we don't have serious infrastructure problems in this country has really never been to New York City or tried to get the hell out of New York City. And in the third hour, we're going to talk with Adam Weinstein. He's the national security reporter over at Mother Jones Magazine. Going to be talking about the GI Bill and the rise of these for-profit colleges and the amount, just the obscene amount of taxpayer dollars going to these for-profit universities and colleges who are paying just mind-blowing CEO salaries. You know, when they were talking about the guy from Penn State? I think he makes, what, about $800,000 a year, maybe $1 million? These guys are taking $10, $20, $30 million. And you don't hear the same kind of outrage. You don't hear the same kind of anger that I would expect. And I think a big part of it is most people don't know. It's one of those things that has gone under the current. It's something that they've done a very nice job of keeping that whole for-profit status, you know, kind of under the covers. But we all know who they are: Kaplan, DeVry, ITT, University of Phoenix, big money. And we're going to talk about that with Adam Weinstein. Also, your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. So the big news today, class warfare. I guess, you know, the Republicans now think that there's class warfare going on and we need to fight back against the president. And personally, I got to be honest, it's about damn time somebody realized there's class warfare going on in this country besides Warren Buffett. It's about time that the people who are getting screwed stand up and say no more, which is why I'm happy to see the people in New York. And we were there for a little bit on Sunday with my daughter and I. And, you know, I think there should be tens of thousands of people out there. We should all have a moment of anger. We should all be marching on our capitals. But that's going to take some more organization. So today the president outlined his plan to trim some deficits and adding this thing he's calling the Buffett rule. And, you know, we've talked about Warren Buffett in the past. The reality is we want to ensure that people making over $1 million a year, you know what? They pay at least as high as the tax rate that the people that work for them. The president said that middle-class families shouldn't pay higher taxes than millionaires and billionaires. That's pretty straightforward. It's hard to argue against that, he said. Warren Buffett's secretary shouldn't pay a higher tax rate than Warren Buffett. There's just no justification for it, he said. He goes on to say anyone who says we can't change the tax code to correct that, anyone who has signed some pledge to protect every single tax loophole, so long as they live, they should be called out, and they should have to defend that unfairness. And I love his attack on the pledges. He says if their pledge is to keep that kind of unfairness in place, they should remember. The last time I checked, the president said, the only pledge that really matters is the pledge we make to uphold the Constitution. So it's a nice shot at these people who have taken Norquist's anti-tax pledge. And So now he comes out with this, and this all the same suspects, all the usual defenders, all the people out there defending the loopholes, defending the big oil and gas companies out there doing their thing, saying, "Oh, this is just class warfare." And the president came out and said, "Look, you know, the reality is, I reject the idea that asking a hedge fund manager to pay the same tax rates as a plumber or a teacher is class warfare." He says, "I think it's just the right thing to do." And he went on to say, "This is not class warfare, it's math." So, you know, when I thought of this, I saw this and I go, "Well, you know, it's not class warfare, it's math. There's going to be a war on math next. Understand, you know, they're going to fight the numbers. If they can't fudge them, they will fight them." And you saw right away, almost within minutes, Paul Ryan was out there offering the same tired lines. The president's engaging in class warfare. He says, you know, we can't divide people. We can't prey on people's fear. We can't prey on their envy and anxiety. I'm going, really? Isn't that Republican 101? Is that what you learned on the first day when you got your little GOP badge? And you're like, great, to an extent, we need a system that creates jobs and innovation. You said in November of 2010, you were that guy. Your party was going to create jobs, and you were going to create jobs, and you were going to create jobs. I remember 1, 2, and 3, jobs, jobs, jobs. Yet we haven't seen anything, nothing. All we've seen is the same tired policy that got us into the mess we're in right now. So he attacked the Buffett rule, said, "Oh, you know, well, they pay their taxes." And I said, "Really? You know, Buffett's a billionaire. He's the guy who says, you know, when I do my taxes," and he doesn't do any loopholing. He doesn't look for deductions that aren't obviously apparent to someone who files the EZ form. And he pays a lower effective tax rate than his secretary does. And I'm struck by this whole argument that, oh, you're engaging in class warfare, and that it's simply going to divide the country more. Really? Can we get much more divided? I think this is a unifying thing. I think finally the working class of this country goes, you know, this is what we've been talking about, taxed enough already here, right here in the middle class. Those of us who swing a hammer and clean the offices, taxed enough. But we still need schools, and we still need roads, and we still need bridges, and we still need a military, and we still need a police department, and we still need all these things. Somebody's got to pay for it. And the people who pay for it are the people who have all the money. And this isn't dividing people. This is saying there are some people who have the resources to be able to afford it, and there are people who don't. That's reality. But, you know, now we're being looked at as, how dare you ask the wealth class for more? How dare you? They're the job creators. And the reality is they're not creating jobs. And they're not going to create jobs. Fact of the matter is they're sitting on trillions of dollars. Oh, but I know. They're uncertain. No, what they're doing is they're buying back all of their assets. They're setting themselves up for the future. So I look at what the president did today, and I add this to his proposed $447 billion job plan, and I say, you know what, maybe this guy's growing a backbone after all. Maybe there's some spine in there after all. Maybe a steel rod was implanted in his last vacation. I don't know. So this is, to me, a good thing. But what I find interesting is the Republicans are all, you know, they're worried about the job creators. Worried about and these mythical job creators. You know, they're out there. We probably driving around with the welfare queen and the family farmer who lost his farm because of the estate tax. Probably cruising around together. But they're worried about this mythical job creator. What about the job destroyers? What about the people who deliberately destroy jobs? I look at Merck, the CEO there, their big head guy there, Richard Clark, pocketed almost $18 million last year. Then they announced they're gonna kick to the curb some 13,000 workers. And when he kicked those 13,000 people to the curb, guess what happened to his pocket? Got heavier. A little bit more in there. Look at Brian Moynihan, the guy from Bank of America. He pulled in a cool $10 million last year. They just announced 30,000 new job cuts. What are we going to do? What are we going to do there? Those are the job destroyers. How do you fix that? Oh, you don't. That's right. Because we have a perverted system. And the system is that the more you can shed costs, the more the CEOs make. So if you don't have a tax rate that's going to say, you know what, we're going to bring some of that down, you're just encouraging more of the same behavior. Just a thought. And I look at this representative from Louisiana, this John Fleming. Again, another one of these extraordinarily wealthy people who sits in our Congress. Now, Mr. Fleming, he owns, and good for him. I mean, you know, you got to give the guy credit. He has done business-wise all the right things. He owns 33 Subway restaurants, the little sandwich shops. He owns a number of the UPS store chains that you see. He owns them in Louisiana, Mississippi, Texas, a whole bunch of them. You know, to be honest, I wonder where he'll be on the Postal Service when that comes up, owning UPS stores, but that's a whole other thing. I look at what he was on MSNBC with Chris Jansen, and I guess I just have to play the clip because, you know, they're talking about, you know, him having money, and they're talking about, you know, what happens with his business, and he made a whole bunch of money, and he, listen to his clip.
Since my net income, and again, that's the individual rate that I told you about, the amount that I have to reinvest in my business and feed my family is more like $600,000 of that $6.3 million. And so by the time I feed my family, I have, you know, maybe $400,000 left over.
So, you know, he's making the argument that, you know, his business takes in about $6.3 million a year. And he pays his employees, which he should. You know, he pays all his bills. And then he's got about $600 left to feed his family. So after he feeds his family, which, you know, $200,000 you kind of got to wonder about, he's got $400,000 left over. And he's trying to make the argument that, you know, he just can't afford one more penny of taxation. Just can't afford it. It's just not there. Sorry. And trying to make the whole argument. And then the woman, you got to give her credit, this Chris Jansen, she says, look, do you get the fact that people are struggling? Do you get the fact that they're broke? And he seemed, you know, in watching the clip, he seemed to be not there. And I find it quite interesting. So as I look through this whole thing, and you got to give the president credit, I don't think what he's laid out doesn't stand a snowball's chance of passing, but it's worth having the discussion. And this is something Republicans have been very, very good at over the years. They cast a wide net. They give you their wish list. They put everything on there. They just seem to be better negotiators. They throw more demands on the table, more outrageous demands on the table as well. But in turn, they get many more of those than the Democrats ever do. I just think Democrats are just bad at negotiating, it must be. Maybe we should put a couple of union people on those negotiating committees. Maybe then we'd get something. But it is what it is. So we're going to be talking about this today, the tax issue, the president's speech today, my trip to New York. And when we come back, we're going to talk about this English-only thing like we talked about last week. But I've got State Representative Scott Perry, one of the sponsors of one of the bills, House Bill 888. He's going to be here talking about this. And maybe we can get him to talk about a couple other things. We'll do that. So we're going to take a quick break. Right back, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Back with Representative Scott Perry.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. On Thursday, the House passed what's been called by opponents the Outsourcers' Bill of Rights. H.R. 2587 hobbles the power of not just the National Labor Relations Board, but also the courts when it comes to acting punitively against companies that perform illegally. According to a statement signed by more than 100 professors who analyzed the legislation, the bill eliminates any meaningful remedy for an employer's refusal to bargain with a union in circumstances where it's required to do so before transferring or contracting out work. California Representative George Miller spoke passionately from the floor against the legislation, which went on to pass with a vote of 238 to 186.
This bill is really about working Americans all across this country, and they should pay very careful attention to this bill and to this debate because it affects their livelihood, their ability to support their families, the safety of their jobs at work, the conditions under which they work, and their ability to participate in their increased productivity in higher wages and better conditions. This bill takes the rights away from workers, from all workers, all across the country. This isn't just about whether you belong to a union or not. This is about whether or not your employer can retaliate against you by taking your work away, by sending your work down the road or out of the country.
What's the real monstrous lie about Social Security? Doug Cunningham explains.
Don't believe the big lie that Social Security is teetering on bankruptcy and won't be there for future generations. It's a monstrous lie about Social Security. A new Social Security issue brief from the Center on Economic and Policy Research says that even if no further changes are made to the program, Social Security remains fully solvent through 2038. Recognizing the fact that Social Security is in no danger of failing, President Obama is leaving it out of his new deficit reduction proposal. Social Security in no way contributes to the deficit. For 77 years, it's paid for itself and generated huge surpluses. All that needs to happen to make sure Social Security is there for our elderly for another 77 years after 2038 is to require that Social Security taxes be paid on incomes above the current limit of $106,800 a year. That's according to an actuarial projection at socialsecurity.gov based on the Social Security Trustees 2010 report. If high-income folks pay the same Social Security tax as the rest of us, the program remains fully funded with no cuts in benefits. The big truth is that Social Security is rock solid, with only minor changes needed to fully fund it at current benefit levels for another 75 years.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Where family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm on a Mexican radio. And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. You know, I remember a history teacher I had back in high school who responded to my disinterest in his class, telling me that I had better learn my history lessons so that when I noticed them coming back around, I could see it. And like many things, he was spot on. He was a bright guy. The more things change, the more they seem to stay the same. And you look at the xenophobia that was created by the Know-Nothing Party of the 1840s and 1850s. That seems to be reemerging before our very eyes. Only this time, and it's not the Germans and the Irish Catholics. It's the Latinos and the Indians. And I guess the one positive thing out of this is Pennsylvania seems to be right on the cutting edge of the movement, at least when you look at this English-only thing. That's why I have asked Scott Perry, Pennsylvania State Representative, and the sponsor of House Bill 888, to come talk to us. It's titled The Official Language Act. Representative Perry, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, Rick, good to talk to you. How are you?
I'm good. You know, I'm looking at this, and I got the first question I've got is, who wrote House Bill 888?
Well, I and, you know, unfortunately a bunch of lawyers on the staff that make sure it's in that bill speak that legislation seems to come out in.
Yeah, because, you know, I'm looking at the two of them, Rosemary Schwanger's 361 and your 888, and they seem to be close.
Sure.
Almost identical.
Right. So she's got a provision, I think, that specifically enumerates the ability to sue whatever agency doesn't comport with or comply with the law if it were to be passed.
Okay. So
mine doesn't have that.
Let me ask you the big question. What are you trying to accomplish with this?
A little bit of unity, Rick. That's what I can't understand. I mean, xenophobia? Really? Do you think I have a fear or hatred? It's not about fear or hatred. Look, there's so much to be divisive about. Listen, whether I listen to talk radio during the day or the Rick Smith Show at night, there's no end to the tripe just goes on and on about we hate this side or we hate that side. Tell me what is positive about our government promoting the divisions among us as opposed to the one thing that should unite us.
Well, it's not about dividing us. It's about being welcoming to those folks that we've welcomed into our country.
We're not saying you're not welcome. There's nobody saying you're, as a matter of fact, we're saying please come.
But those
please
people
come.
who are struggling to learn the language, you are now saying that your government is not going to be a helping hand in this.
Let me ask you this, Rick. Do you believe that citizens and people that come here should obey the law?
Absolutely.
So do you know that it's an immigration policy that if you're going to become a naturalized American citizen, you have to have a functional knowledge of English? So who am I harming?
And I'm in favor of people learning English. I'm against the idea of having this kind of hostile environment, because I don't see the point in it. There are so many things that are going on right now. There are so many people unemployed. There are so many people losing their homes that we're now talking about something that, in my opinion, you seem to think that this is going to unite us. I think this divides us.
Well, listen, this isn't the only thing that's going to unite us, first of all. Number two, I don't necessarily disagree with you regarding the priorities. We've got a lot on our plate, and there are a lot of bigger issues, arguably, than this one. But this is nothing new, Rick. As you know, it already passed the House once in 2006, and I introduced it in 2007, and it's just been sitting out there waiting for somebody to have a hearing on it, and that's what happened. The State Government Committee had a hearing, and now everybody's up in arms like this is some kind of new epiphany. It's not. But at the same time, people say, well, you know, Perry, you talk about cutting the budget, and you talk about cutting government. Well, where, you know, give us some ideas. Listen, nobody even keeps track of how much money we're spending. I just ran the numbers on what we spend in education, which, by the way, is growing exponentially for English language learners and English as a second language in Pennsylvania and across the nation, and I come up with $200 to $500 million annually just for that, and it's growing. You know, people's property taxes are going up, and they wonder, you know, what's driving it, and one of the things that's driving it is this. Why not promote something? We're not saying we don't want you to learn English. We absolutely want you to learn English. Why don't we do something to promote that?
I'm in favor of promoting, helping people. What you're talking about is $200 to $500 million, the number you've thrown out there, is for programs to help people learn English and to help them assimilate into society. So where is that money going to go, and where is it going to come from to help them learn the language
first
down the road?
First of all, Rick, this legislation does nothing to imperil or impede that money. What we're trying to do over time is reduce the need for it. People used to come here and they taught in their homes so that when your child showed up at first grade, had some functional knowledge of English. Now they're showing up in fifth grade and they have no clue.
Well, I mean, that's a whole other social problem that we have to deal with.
But our government rules are promoting it. We have various agencies that print things in foreign language and distribute government information in a myriad of different languages. How is that promoting it? Number one. Number two, aren't we leaving ourselves up for criticism of being discriminatory? Whether, you know, some agencies print in Japanese and Spanish and some only in English, or some in Russian and three other languages and the next one only in English. I mean, where's the fairness there?
But with today's technology, we're not talking about something that's an obstacle so great that we can't accomplish it.
Well,
you brought up something a second ago that I absolutely agree with. This is not a new issue. When I've done some reading on labor history, you know, most of my life. And the reason I brought up the know-nothing era is, you know, that's what it came out of, this whole English-only fight of the 1830s and the 1840s. This is not a new issue. We're not reinventing the wheel. These are the same arguments that we've been hearing for years. And at the end of the day, English is still the predominant language. You're talking about a very small number of people who, for a very short period of time, hold on to their language, because English, I don't know if you know, is a kind of a difficult language to learn.
Yeah, there's about probably upward of 300,000 different English words compared to other languages that maybe have 30,000. Yeah, but doesn't mean you have to use all 300,000 up there to maybe 400,000. You don't have to, but it's a beautiful language, and it is the language of our culture. And again, it's the one thing that binds us all together among all our differences.
And eventually, you know, here's the thing. I had friends growing up, you know, whose parents were first generation.
Yeah.
And they spoke very little broken English. The second generation, the kids that I were friendly with, they spoke both languages frequently. I now know that their children don't speak the home language at all.
Yeah.
It's the assimilation process. So what frightens me, and this is, you know, this is more to the point. What frightens me is the venom that's being whipped up in all this. The xenophobia, you know, this hatred that this whole thing is whipping up. I'm just not.
But Rick, who's whipping up the venom? Certainly it's not me. First of all, I come from a Hispanic family, and I'm exactly what you spoke about. You know, my mother speaks Spanish fluently, but I speak barely any Spanish because she wouldn't teach it to me. She said, you're American, you're going to learn English, and that's how you're going to be productive and prosperous and successful, not by speaking Spanish. But what we're finding, if you look at the demographics, is that is no longer the case in America, where the first generation spoke very little, the next generation spoke predominantly, and finally the third generation didn't speak any of the native language of the forefathers. That's not what we're seeing. The demographic is changing, and how are we going to maintain our culture? It's not about xenophobia. It's about maintaining who we are as Americans. And if the people say, well, you know, it can't go extinct, well, look at Canada and some of the provinces there. Are we going to fight over this? It's not. I don't think we need to fight over it, but is it too bad? Is it so awful to have a discussion about it? And it's not about hatred or fear. It's about not only preserving our culture, uniting our communities, and saving the tax dollars where they should be spent.
But there are some that what they're going to get out of this is this hyper nationalistic hatred of others. And that's my problem in this. And you know, my daughter, I had an opportunity this weekend to go to Liberty Island in New York with my 9-year-old daughter. And we got to see the Statue of Liberty, and we got to see exactly what we were just talking about, the three generations,
right,
standing side by side, from virtually every ethnicity we could imagine. And you could see it right in their faces. You knew the grandmother didn't speak any English. The father was the interpreter, or the mother was the interpreter. And the child was as American as any child in this country. So when I look at this, I got to be honest, I just see this as a waste of productive time and of energy, because eventually people do assimilate, at least everyone that I've met.
But eventually, along the way, Rick, you and I and every other taxpayer whose budgets are strained as well are paying more and more for it. And you know what? I think it's somewhat irresponsible, too, that no government, whether the federal or the state, tracks the expense. We have no idea, really, how much we're spending.
And
that responsible?
That's something you should be looking at. And before you go passing something like this, maybe you should know what the numbers are. You know, because I'm sorry, the English as a second language thing, I don't think that applies to this, because, as you said, that's going to continue on. My other problem with this is there's already Supreme Court case law on this. Back in the 1920s, there was Meyer versus Nebraska. It was ruled unconstitutional back then because it violated due process.
Well, there might be Supreme Court action, but there's also 31 states that have made this the law of their state.
So my question then becomes is how much of my tax dollars is going to go into fighting this, going to the Supreme Court to try and do this?
Because why isn't your question how much your tax dollars are going to go to fight discrimination claims by those who say you provide services in this language but not in the next language?
Is it that hard to provide in someone's home language?
It's not hard.
With the translation?
It's not hard. Let me ask you this. Why isn't it incumbent upon those who don't speak English to look at their computer, get a program that interprets and interpret for themselves? Why is Rick Smith and Scott Perry and everybody else paying for it?
Well, it's an interesting question. It's a good question. But here's the thing. You're citizens here. You have rights. And, that right is that your government has to communicate with you at some level. And there should be reasonable accommodation to make sure that you have that ability.
So I guess the question is reasonable then.
Well, I mean, if you have a document, that is something you need to communicate with people, you should be able to at least communicate with them. No? I mean, haven't we been having this discussion since, well, the beginning of immigration, I guess.
The beginning of immigration. Rick, you must understand that our diversity is what makes us strong, but only in the fact that we're all seeking the same, generally speaking, seeking the same goal. If we all have our own interest in our diversity, then that makes us a fractionalized society. And I see this as a way to segregate us and people to find ways to divide and have their own little community among our community. How does that unite us?
Let me ask you a last question on this before, because I do have a couple of things I want to ask you. How's this going to play if we pass this with federal mandates, like voting rights?
The federal mandates will still be required. It doesn't have any effect to them whatsoever.
All right. So we're still going to print ballots for people to vote, but we're not going to tell them how to get to the voting poll, is what,
right,
what you're telling me. Okay. I just want to make sure that's.
Well, we'll tell them, but we'll tell them in English.
Okay. Well, there you go. I had a couple other questions that I wanted to get to since I've got you. You know, I look at this scheme that Senator Pileggi has put forth.
Yeah.
I wanted to get your take on it.
Well, I am guarded about the thing. I don't like tampering with anything structural for the most part. And so, you know, I still think just like the current system is a double-edged sword where some folks might not be happy this year and happy the next, this is the same thing. So, you know, Like I said, I'm guarded about the thing. I want to really proceed with caution. It concerns me, of course, that the governor and he are for it very quickly out of the gate, but I'm not saying I'm against it yet. I just need to sit there and say to myself, what's this really going to affect and why are we doing this? If it increases voter, participation without fundamentally putting our system out of whack, because I'm a guy that believes in the Electoral College, believe it or not. I think it can be a good thing because I'd like to see more people participate. But if we're just trying to do it so that one side has the upper hand over the other, I don't really think that any citizens really stand for that. They'd like to see, you know, the adversarial relationship that we have so that public policy doesn't go too fast or too one-sided.
I personally think it's a power grab. And that's my partisan view.
Yeah.
The other part of me says that what this will do if we do go down this path, it'll make Pennsylvania irrelevant. And
well, there's a lot of people that makes Pennsylvania relevant. Right now they say we're irrelevant, and that irritates a lot of people, which is why they don't go vote, especially during presidential elections, saying that the contest is already decided by the time we get there because, you know, half the primary candidates have dropped out, regardless of which side of the aisle you're on.
I still view Pennsylvania as a swing state and one that could go either way for at any time. Because,
well, we always say that, but what's it really? How has it swung in the last two or three presidential elections? I mean, it hasn't been swinging much.
Yeah, but it's also been competitive, and there's been an awful lot of time, energy, and resource spent.
Also true.
You brought up the fact that you like to see people participate in the in the election, which kind of struck me on an interesting chord with all this voter ID stuff, the suppression that's going on. I've got a grandmother, 84 years old, hasn't had a driver's license in probably 10 years.
Right.
She doesn't have an ID. I know people who, you know, don't have automobiles, don't have IDs.
Right.
They've been voting in the same polls for years. But now, here in Pennsylvania, we're talking about pushing through this another scheme to solve a problem that I don't think exists.
Well, you don't think it exists, Rick, because you don't see Philadelphia precincts that vote 100% even before the polls open. Listen, this fraud is out there, and it's fomented and conducted by both parties, okay? So let's not mince any words here. Is it really so bad to produce an identification when I have to produce one to buy liquor at the state store, when I have to produce one to get on an airplane, when I have to produce one for a myriad of different reasons, to buy cigarettes? I don't smoke, but if I did, you know, they're supposed to card me. Really? You can't produce an ID to engage in the most precious right that Americans have. I don't think it's too much. I have to produce identification to avail myself to my Second Amendment rights.
For you and me, and you know, Scott, at this moment in my life, I'll agree with you. Absolutely. Yeah. At this moment in my life. Because I have the ability to go and get a license. I have the ability to do, I have the resources. If I need to pay for it, I can do that. My grandmother doesn't have the luxury of, you know, going downtown or getting out to the voting registration office during the times prescribed. There are poor people in this country who don't have the ability to take a day off work and to go do these things. So to me, it's one of those things that it looks like we're trying to hold that number of people going to the polls down.
No,
and that's what it looks like on an outward level.
I certainly can understand your perspective, but I just see it a different way. I see it as, yeah, absolutely, it is a burden to your freedom, and I'm a freedom guy. We have a lot of burdens on our freedom, but we're saying that it's more important that we have the integrity of the voting system in America preserved than have questions for the sake of a few folks that either refuse to, can't be bothered to, or really have a difficult time getting identification. And I would suspect, Rick, I certainly will tell you this straight up. If somebody calls my office and says, hey, look, I don't have a car, I don't have a whatever, I'm 80 years old, I got to get this identification from PennDOT and I can't get there. Give me your address, I'll be right over.
Okay, we're going to hold.
Thank you.
When you guys push this through, I will make sure we hold you that.
Yeah, please do.
We will, absolutely, because Nikki Haley down in South Carolina said the same thing, but when asked, kind of changed her mind. But we're going to hold you to your word there.
Okay, buddy.
Last question I've got for you, Rick. You know, looking at the wine and spirit shops.
Yeah.
I understand House Bill 11 is going to be one of the first to run. What's the point of this? I mean, it's another privatization scheme, in my opinion, that we, the taxpayers, are not going to benefit from as we have from the sale and the holding of these stores as a public asset.
Well, listen, I mean, there's plenty of empirical data to say whichever side of the argument on that you're right. So, you know, figures lie and liars figure. But in a fundamental sense, I don't think of it as a scheme. I think what we have right now is a scheme. I don't understand why the state government is in the business of purveying what's a questionable substance to a lot of people with the same. So we're marketing that. We're using state dollars to market it. And then we tell you, oh, we really don't use it. And then we're going to set up a roadside checkpoint to you know, check everybody's breath, including mine, and I don't drink when I go through it, and hold me up from getting home to see my wife and kids. We're on the wrong side of the issue, and I think that the finances will bear it out. Might it be perfect as soon as we get out of the gate? It probably won't. But the plan now isn't perfect, and the liquor system contributes to the state fund. It's at its own peril. Governor Rendell raided it on several occasions and put them in arrears. I mean, that's number one. I mean, for me, it's just a fundamental, what should government be doing? What business should we be in? And we shouldn't be in the business of private business. We're one of two states that do this.
Right. And I would say we're in the business of protecting our citizens. Because as it stands now.
But we're not getting rid of the LCB. The protection is still there.
But we're increasing the number of stores that are going to be carrying liquor. We're going to be increasing the opportunity. Because I got to be honest, I grew up in Cleveland.
Yeah.
A place where I could walk into any 7-Eleven gas station, I can buy beer, I could buy wine, and I could buy anything under 42 proof.
Right.
And as a 15-year-old kid, I was able to do that quite often. As a parent who is now a hypocrite, I don't want my 15-year-old children to be able to do that. It's one thing when I was doing it.
Anybody below the age of majority and the age of the law to do so to be able to avail themselves to it, and that's where strict and very heavy-handed enforcement has to come in. But we don't punish the law-abiding citizens in the district I represent and so many others that say, for the love of God, why must I travel 15, 20 miles to go to a state store with these arcane hours and you know, I buy liquor here, and then I go buy a case of beer here and a six-pack there. Pennsylvania is in the 19th century on this thing, and that's number two. It's the right thing to do because we shouldn't be in the business, and number two, we better get in the 21st century and give the people, the voters, what they want. This is legislation's running because the voters want this.
Really? To be honest, most of the people that I talk to, they're like me. They're adults about their drinking habits. They know where alcohol is. When they need a bottle of something, they plan ahead. They know how to get it. To me, the system works just fine. It just seems to be a matter of, planning. I don't want alcohol, as I was, in Cleveland. I don't want it to be the impulse item next to the Tic Tacs on the checkout aisle.
Hey, listen, some people don't want it at all. Should we just get rid of it altogether? I mean, it creates all kinds of havoc and drunk driving, et cetera.
I'm not saying that.
I'm just saying
that it's an adult substance, and that adults should be adult about it, know where they get it, know how to consume it.
With you, Rick, but this is a free country, and if we're saying adults should be adult about it, why can't they exercise their freedom and be adults and act lawfully? And if they can't, then they need to be penalized, but we're punishing those who would act lawfully for the sake of the few that don't. That's not fair either.
No, On a slight level, you're right. But again, I've been in an environment where we have mass competition with liquor, and I see what happens.
Listen, I was in the environment too when I was growing up. Everybody drove south to the border of Maryland, right across the line, to drink because their drinking age was still 18. Did that make it right? Absolutely not. And then the highway was littered with the bodies of teenagers that did that. But here again, is that the person that drinks responsibly and abides by the law's fault? And should we punish them?
I don't see that I'm being punished by having a store where I go to pick that up. That's just my
sure,
sentiment on
sure.
it. And that's something we'll probably disagree on, and we'll see where this whole thing takes us. Scott Perry, always great talking to you. Would love
Good
to have you back again
you,
real
Rick.
Soon.
Yep, absolutely. Have a great evening.
Thank you. You too. Interesting. We're going to take a quick break. That was Representative Scott Perry. His website, repperry.com. We'll put a link at therickssmithshow.com if you're interested. We're going to take a break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
The Rick Smith Show.
President Obama has joined the perky posse of national leaders who are urging Americans to be more upbeat about the economic doldrums we're in. Shake off all the naysaying and the anxiety and the hand-wringing, he recently told us, sounding a lot like a football coach telling a player to shake off a concussion and get back in the game. The president's pep talk came the day after he made his bold jobs proposal to Congress. But Obama's plan is more Walter Mitty-ish than Rooseveltian. While it does have some useful provisions to keep from losing still more jobs, the core of Obama's plan consists of two more corporate tax breaks, a form of bribery to induce enormously rich corporations to hire American workers. This is the same old that Washington keeps throwing at the problem, and hello, Washington, it's not working. Sure enough, corporate chieftains say they'll gladly take the latest handout, but we should not expect them to go on a big hiring spree. Mostly, they'll use the money to cover the few people they were going to hire anyway, and pocket the rest. Nonetheless, Obama is now barnstorming the country, rallying crowds to demand that Congress, quote, stop the political circus and actually do something to help the economy by passing his plan. Fine, but what about the corporate circus and the Wall Street circus? It's time to stop coddling these gluttonous narcissists. America is in crisis, sinking toward depression. The president should really get bold by calling out and shaming corporate executives who suck up America's wealth, then turn their backs on us, as though the only loyalty they owe is to their own avarice, none to their country. Likewise, he should kick the bailed-out bankers right in their ample butts and insist publicly that they start making loans to America's smaller businesses that do want to create good jobs in our country. This is Jim Hightower saying, let's stop begging and start demanding.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
The rich pay too much taxes. The poor get paid too much. Instead of schools, build prisons. Lock the children up. We won't believe those lies again, because God is a Republican.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. English only, yes, no? Which way do we go with this? You know, this weekend for me was an interesting weekend. I had some business in New York City, and I had the opportunity to take my nine-year-old daughter to New York for her very first time. So I got to mix a little business, a little pleasure. I got to go to a friend's birthday party who, just is a wonderful salt of the earth, person. But it was one of those weekends where you come back from it and you go, there's a lesson in here. There's absolutely a lesson. And Saturday night, I'll just run through it, and maybe you'll see it too. Saturday night, we ended up at a friend's, her birthday party. It wasn't so much of a birthday party as it was a fundraiser, because she does an awful lot of philanthropic work. If it's not in Mississippi, it's in the Sudan. If it's not there, it's somewhere else. She's into everything. And one of the things she's done is she's been going to the Sudan for several years, taking them, food and goats and helping them sell, make jewelry and sell it back here and all kinds of stuff. And she met this one kid, his name was Kerr. And Kerr was a slave until his slave master, angry that he had allowed a goat to get out of his care, hung Kerr upside down, put chilies in his eyes, and lit a fire under him so that the smoke would burn his eyes. And this left Kerr blind. So Ellen saw this kid, found this kid, brought him back to the U.S., got him surgery so that this kid can see shapes, and he's not seeing too many colors, but he can see shapes and stuff out of one eye. So he's got some vision back. And my daughter was struck by this. I mean, you hear tales about people, about slavery being years and years ago, but to actually stand next to somebody who at one point in their life was a slave, and that they were beaten and tortured and blinded, is something very powerful. And we bought one of the necklaces that the folks back in the Sudan had made so that she would remember it. And that she would, at some point down the line, remember what a great country this is. And the next day we went to Liberty Island. Went to see the Statue of Liberty. And I got to be honest with you, I have never felt so proud, so patriotic, so in love with my country. That this beacon of freedom, this symbol to the world, where all the people around us, the mass of humanity, the thousands of people who are on Liberty Island with us, speaking every language, I couldn't even tell you. In generational form, grandma was there, grandpa was there, mom and dad, the kids, right down. And to have this unity in our country, to me, spoke something. It gave the message that, you know what, this is the melting pot. And it does work the way we had talked about earlier. The first generation comes, they struggle with the language. It's a difficult language. The kids, the second generation, they learn the language and they know both because they're the interpreter. And the third generation, they basically forget all of the first language. They're now solidly Americans, and you saw it played out. Indians, French, Russians, you know, all across the ethnicities. They were all there in one place admiring this beacon of freedom, this beacon of liberty. And I look at this and I think about how divisive and how this English-only thing can only divide us. And I understand the argument that our language unites us. No. Our love of freedom, our love of this country, our love of what this nation stands for unites us. That's what unites us. So I'm comparing these two things, the fact that all of these people are on this island adoring this statue, adoring this vision of this country. And the night before her having taken a photograph with a slave who had his vision stolen from him by an evil master. How do you explain that? And as we were coming back home, my daughter hadn't finished her homework. And it's one of those moments where you go, something cosmic is happening, something out of my control, something preordained, if you will. Her homework assignment was to research who Clara Barton was. And for anybody who knows, Clara Barton was a teacher. She was a nurse during the war who gave aid and comfort to the soldiers. But she was also the founder of the American Red Cross. And I stopped and I thought about, you know, my friend Ellen, who does all of this philanthropic work around the world and the aid and the comfort that she's given to people over the years, and how all of this just kind of comes together. And the final piece of it was she had to define, in her opinion, what a, quote, bird and a feather flock together mean. And I just, you know, my mind was working all around this, and I'm going, you know, there's something here. This tribal mentality. Of that quote, this, you know, we're white people here, we speak this language here. There, you know, I remember about, it was about the melting pot. I remember the Schoolhouse Rock videos as of yesterday, where we throw a little bit of this and a little bit.
Or is it the magic of humans doing what humans do best and building real community? One of the things that the article brings up is that you will not be allowed to not be a member of the community. You will be cajoled out of your little hermit hole to come and participate in the singing, in the dancing, in drinking the wine. in the potlucks and the green and the gathering of the greens, in the slaughter of the goat. I think the etymology of the word tragedy has something to do with the sound a goat makes before it knows it's going to the slaughter, because they know, especially when it's a little goat. The PETA people are weeping in the aisles right now. Would it be possible, in the midst of the consumerist, capitalized, free market madness that is this country, to have that community? And the Loma Linda Seventh-day Adventist culture suggests yes. Second question, can you do this without an imaginary friend? I'll bet you the answer to that is yes, too. Dr. John writes in, he says, eat like a forager, live longer. It's simply true, Bob. The San foragers of the Kalahari, the Maasai pastoralists of East Africa, are among the healthiest populations on Earth. That's the case with basically anyone who doesn't eat a Western diet. Lots of processed foods, lots of sugars and carbs. The Maasai eat mostly products from their cows, milk and yogurt and blood. Yet they have lower incidence of heart disease, high cholesterol, and cancer than Americans do. Among the San, broad-ranging foragers whose diet is almost entirely raw, cavities and diabetes are unknown. If you live past infancy, a somewhat riskier proposition, but not horrifyingly so, you're as likely in a small-scale foraging or pastoral culture to live into your 70s as we are, and more likely to reach your 80s and 90s. We started to die earlier and spend our final years in decline once we started intensive farming. That's also, incidentally, when we started to own things. And we developed priests and kings and cops to keep everyone quiet about this great invention, hierarchy, that had sprung up. Hell of a trade, isn't it? Why don't you be my serf? And I'll make your life miserable for about 50 years, and then you, okay, 40, and then you get to die. Sound good? Good, let's settle down and build a castle. And a cathedral. I think it was established quite some time back, John can correct me if I'm wrong, that based upon the evidence we have, hunter-gatherers actually had more leisure time than you or I in this, the greatest country in the world. That's why I get kind of misty-eyed when I think about the cultures that white folks overran when they came to this continent. I saw a brilliant cartoon by the artist Boers on my Facebook page today. Boers has apparently got a Kickstarter campaign going to try to fund the self-publishing of a book of his cartoons. And I've seen his stuff in the past. He's brilliant. I'm sure you're familiar with him. But Michael, another Michael, posted it on my Facebook wall, the Boers cartoon compendium called Life Begins at Incorporation. Looks like it'd be worth having. And there's one cartoon that features a couple of Indians sitting out on the res, young guy, old guy, listening to the radio. Out of the radio comes the announcer voice, non-white babies now outnumber white babies in America for the first time. And the older of the two Indians says, second. took me a minute. But it's true. Jack from Shreveport writing in about Icaria. Maybe they live longer, at least in part, because every minute of their lives is not spent competing against each other or some other group, whereas we live in a society in which there's even competition for what pre-kindergarten program a child gets into. So, American way. Jack also notes in regard to leisure time that even peasants in the kingdoms had more leisure time than we do. Yeah. So, like I said, just a little interlude to get us started on this Thorn in the Side Thursday. On the way, the Green News Report, Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen, and then your calls, 304-658-3333. If you've got, we had great audio from Jan in the UK last night, and Skype is up and running. No, it's not. It will be in a minute. If you want to join in that way, just search for Bob Kincaid Horn, BobKincaidHorn, and we'll get you on the air that way. It's all very doable, and every last bit of it is an exercise in this now 8-year-long attempt at redefining conversation in the internet age, at creating some manifestation of community in a culture that despises it. So we'll be back. Light them up if you want to. The phone lines and anything else for that matter. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. It is your voice. It's conversation radio. And it is, in fact, the horn.
I'm in a hurry to get things done. Oh, I rush and rush until life's no fun. All I really gotta do is live and die, but I'm in a hurry and don't know why. Don't know. Drive so fast, my car has nothing to prove. It's not new, but it'll do 0 to 60 in 5.2. rushing till life's no fun. All I really gotta do is live and die, but I'm in a hurry and don't know why.
Thursday, October 25th, 2012.
I think it's going to be a big one.
Hurricane Sandy threatens East Coast as new study shows increase in big hurricanes in the U.S. Koch brothers trying to kill wind industry. Judge rules keep the mutants out of the national forests. Plastic pollution now in the Arctic. The ozone hole shrinks. Plus,
so if nothing else changes, the outlook looks pretty bad.
Time's running out to see the Great Barrier Reef. Half of it has been lost in just 30 years.
All of those stories and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Scientists have to stop trying to make Americans care about climate change with big words like carbon and human life.
Okay, I'm with you so far.
They have to explain that it caused a super drought which killed the corn, which was used to feed the hogs, which is causing a bacon shortage. And if you can't make Americans care about something by explaining it in terms of bacon, give up.
I give up. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Des, bacon shortage aside, I know you've got a lot to report about global warming with big words like carbon and hurricanes and stuff like that.
And people and things, yes. While the presidential campaign is in the final stretch, surprise, there are other things happening in the world. Some quick headlines. A federal judge has ordered the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to halt field testing of genetically modified plants on land in the nation's wildlife refuges, at least until full environmental studies can be conducted of the impact of genetically modified plants in areas that are designated to be protected for wildlife.
Why would they want to have genetically modified organisms in a national forest?
Because it's cheap to test them there.
Oh, okay. What could possibly go wrong?
The oil industry is trying to strangle the American wind industry. The U.S. wind industry has been forced to idle factories and lay off workers while waiting to see if Congress will renew the annual wind production tax credit that expires in December. But American Energy Alliance, an oil industry front group with ties to the billionaire Koch brothers, tells Politico that its primary goal in the lame duck session after the election will be to make renewal of the wind energy production tax credit, quote, so toxic that Republicans House Speaker John Boehner can't even consider it.
And that is the tax credit that essentially allows for new wind farms to be built across the U.S.
Yeah, it is the main investment vehicle that has helped explode the wind industry.
Thanks, Koch brothers. You rock.
A Frankenstorm for Halloween?
We are talking about a confluence of events here. We saw kind of a similar thing with the perfect storm in 1991. We could see something similar with this.
As of airtime, it's too early to know if Hurricane Sandy, after pummeling the Caribbean, will hit the East Coast around Halloween, just 1 week before the presidential election, or whether it will veer out to sea. The National Hurricane Center is warning the Northeast to prepare. But the appearance of Hurricane Sandy neatly coincides with a new study recently published showing that extreme hurricanes are hitting the U.S. more frequently now than in the past. An analysis of nearly 100 years of storm surge and tide records show that large Katrina-sized hurricanes are now twice as likely to form off the southeast coast of the United States in warm years rather than in colder years. That's a trend they predict will increase in the future as global warming increases.
And the storm we're talking about here could be potentially a superstorm. This isn't just a regular hurricane. This is a hurricane plus.
Yeah, it could be a real biggie. The warming of the world's oceans is also stressing the world's coral reefs.
There's no exaggeration. This is absolutely unassailable data.
A recent survey of the Great Barrier Reef off the coast of Australia shows that half of the reef has disappeared in just the last 30 years, and the outlook is grim, says John Gunn of the Australian Institute for Marine Science here in an interview with the BBC.
So if nothing else changes, the outlook looks pretty bad. And remember, these changes are happening before the major impacts of climate change have kicked in.
The researchers say the destruction is due to stronger cyclones and warming oceans, but also a voracious starfish that eats coral. It's exploded in population in just a few years due to chemical fertilizer runoff from farms. On the other side of the world, plastic pollution is now at the North Pole. Arctic Ocean biologists in a new survey say photographic evidence shows plastic litter on the seafloor of the Arctic is rapidly increasing and becoming entangled in marine life as shipping traffic increases due to the loss of Arctic sea ice. Finally, some good news.
Finally.
The ozone hole over the South Pole is the second smallest it's been in 20 years, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. The ozone layer protects all life on Earth from the sun's deadly ultraviolet rays. The slow recovery of the ozone layer shows that the world's first international climate treaty to phase out ozone-killing chemicals is actually succeeding. It proves that it can be done.
That was a cap-and-trade treaty from George Bush Sr., as I recall.
Yep, it shows Republicans used to care about such things.
Those were the days. For more on all of those stories and the ones we couldn't get to, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. While you're there, please consider a donation to help sponsor the Green News Report. We rely on you to stay on your public airwaves until the Koch brothers decide to strangle us. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
Minutes past the second hour of the program. I'm Bob Kincaid. This is The Horn, headonradionetwork.com. Remember, if you missed out at the beginning of the program, you can, at least until the podcasts are back up to normal speed again, you can set a recorder at dar.fm and simply record the program and listen to it later. During the break, I had an email come in from Jay. Subject line, simply live. That comes, of course, from the old saying, live simply so that others might simply live. Jay says, Bob, your discussion of simpler lifestyles tonight fits right in with my thinking of late. I spent the winter of 1999-2000 in Nicaragua working with an organization named El Porvenir out of Boulder, Colorado. They're at El Porvenir, ELPORVENIR.org. These Nicaraguan mountain villages are subsistence farmers. They have almost no money. They meet their needs by hard work and cooperation. One thing I took away from my visit to these people was this. While there, I never heard a baby cry. This was because young children are so well taken care of that they have no reason to cry. These are the wonderful people I'm considering joining, or at least emulating. And I don't think anyone would dare suggest, Jay, that that's a bad idea. I dare suggest that, in fact, there's a lot of folks who would like to go with you. But that in itself is a problem, isn't it? To one degree or another, the world's great religions teach that envy is some sort of violation of the universal code. Their word for it is sin. And I'm not talking about Jay going down. I'm talking about this idea that that somehow we must. Oh, how can I put it? Look, we got to reinvent it for ourselves. Sometimes reinventing the wheel is what you have to do. You know, that's an old cliche. Well, you know, you don't want to reinvent the wheel. Maybe sometimes you do. Maybe sometimes the wheel that works on one path will not work on another. It has to be rediscovered. So maybe that's the question. And I say this understanding that other commune/utopian movements have gone across this country from time to time. Among other things, they sprang up like mushrooms after a spring rain in the era that was populated by the thoughts of folks like Emerson and Thoreau. And most of them devolve into heartbreak and failure because they lack the organic, and I don't mean grown without fertile, they lack the organic necessities to make it work. One individual, like the fellow who left America and went back to his home in Icaria, can be absorbed into a community. It is an open question, however, whether a community can spontaneously form. And that's an important inquiry. Because when one has been subjected to a particular lifestyle or life way long enough, the habits are awfully hard to break. That Alabama song I played about I'm in a hurry to get things done, kind of the opposite side of that coin is a Grateful Dead tune I've played from, not Grateful Dead, Talking Heads tune I've played from time to time, called Nothing But Flowers. That was a parking lot. Now it's a peaceful oasis. You got it. You got it. We've caught a rattlesnake. Now we've got something for dinner. You got it. You've got it. It's an open question how long any of us could watch that beautiful sun sink into the wine-dark Aegean before we said, "Please, could I have my internet back?" I don't know what the answers are to the questions for the television generation. Interestingly, these centenarians that are being written about in the article I cited, they're all people who were probably 50 years old before they ever saw a television. How many in our culture would be able to live the day in and day out of that hard work that Jay is talking about that takes place in Central America? Because before you earn your leisure time, you work your ass off. Most all of us have ancestors who did that. I'm within a couple of miles of cemeteries that are chock full of my forebears who lived into their 90s, ate, and passed their genetic material to me, and ate pig fat day in and day out. Their biscuits were made with lard. And they ate probably more pork than anything else. They ate eggs until they did. Right? But what did they do different? They worked their asses off. They rose with the sun and went to bed with it too. Old Ozias Goad, coming in at the end of the day with his three apples from his trees, sitting on a shelf that hung by his rocking chair, his hard-backed wooden rocking chair that was his sitting place of an evening. We still have the cut glass goblet in which my great-grandmother would bring him one glass of warm sugar water that he would sip at as he peeled his apple and shared it out with the children before he read them the Bible and then capped it all off by playing his banjo for them. And in the warm months of summer, the sun might not even have set before everyone was in bed. And in the cold months of winter, well, the sun would have been long gone, and precious oil being burned in a lamp by which to read the Word of God, and then play the music of the soul. Just a little food for thought. I'm so sick of rape as a gift from God. Sick to death of it. Yeah, you can't discount that, Marty. One, they did work their butts off. Two, their food, I'll dare say, was grown locally in earth that was untainted. No agribusiness. Yeah. It's what Dr. John said about surviving past infancy. That really was the hurdle. What, in Elizabethan England, children might be baptized with a name that they were really sort of taken care enough, well enough of to survive, but you didn't get attached to them until they were 7 years old. Because you really didn't have a sense that they would live. And these horses' rear ends from the right wing would dare to tell us that life begins at conception. Why not life begins at implantation of the zygote in the uterine wall? Well, that's bad. Well, because then you'd have to have somebody, you know, to actually monitor when that happens. Well, that's okay. The right wing would be more than happy to provide some womb police, as long as, you know, it was done for profit. No, I'm not having a meltdown or anything. But it's getting pretty thick. On a more personal note, and this is just to keep you abreast of my ongoing medical adventures, I'm sickly. No, I got a rotten gallbladder, and the surgeon, before he goes any further with my gallbladder, wanted me to see a cardiologist. Because, you know, I'm nearly 50, and I come from a family of men who die of heart disease. It's one of those things you start dealing with at 50. So I called. I got hold of the cardiologist today. They said, well, we need to run an echocardiogram, and we want to do a stress test on you. I've had those in the past. It's no big deal. And I said, well, great. And they said, well, you know, we need you to pay for it up front. So can't make payments? Oh, no. How much is it? $1,500 cash on the barrel head. We take MasterCard and Visa. Said, you know anybody that's got one of those I can use? Well, you call the doctor back and say that you refused the appointment. I said, no, ma'am, I'm going to call the doctor back and tell him that you would not schedule one without me bringing you $1,500 cash on the barrel head. Good day. That's my world. And the world of millions of other Americans. This is the kind of thing that we mean when we say that 45,000 Americans die every year, not from untreatable illness, but from lack of access to health care insurance. Welcome to America. So I'm going to do what I can. I got some. I've had some really nice things written to me over the last couple of weeks. Things that one of the big things seems to be Bob consume vinegar. Put a tablespoon of nice organic unfiltered vinegar in a glass of apple juice and chug it once a day. I can do that. I'm gonna. Bob, eat lots of raw garlic. Do that too. But even if I do it, it doesn't change what's being done to the millions of others. Because there are problems far greater than any that I face. And yeah, that's part and parcel of why when I go to the polls, even though it won't mean much here in West Virginia, because they'll probably get beaten 60-40 at least, if not 80-20, because of the war on coal. That's why I will be making my way to the polls, and I will, in fact, be voting for Barack Obama for President of the United States. Because somebody out there is depending on me, too. Millions of somebodies are out there depending on me to do that. The working couple who are too wealthy for Medicaid and yet can't afford, say, Walmart's employer health plan, but could, on January the 1st, 2014, be covered under Medicare under the expanded poverty guidelines. They're depending on me to go and vote for Barack Obama. Yeah, I like Jill Stein's positions a hell of a lot more. But there is not even a 1 in 10 trillion chance of Jill Stein becoming president of the United States. I saw a picture of Pakistani children on Facebook earlier today. And it said, just hope Barack Obama doesn't put them on his kill list. And I was a little bit taken aback. I find the drone strikes to be disgusting. By the same token, I find carpet bombings by B-52s to be equally or more so. But I think what I found most disgusting was this notion that somebody out there, arguably on our side of the fence, thinks that Barack Obama sits around could you bring me some photographs of Pakistani children for my kill list? We wiped out a few dozen, and I've got to catch up. That's odious, too. The murdering is done, and it is murder. Cold-blooded murder. The murdering's done by the CIA like the murdering has always been done by the CIA. Some pimply-faced little kid with a goddamn joystick flying a drone around blasting the bejesus out of weddings, Muslim weddings. Barack Obama's kill list, please. You want to see a kill list? Wait till you see Willard Romney's. Man, you haven't even begun to think about a kill list till you see what happens when a Mormon bishop gets a hard-on for murder. Mountain Meadows, anyone? It's getting a little thick. I admit it. And it's taking a toll on all of us. Sorry if I'm not a hell of a lot of fun. I was actually trying to get away from the swamp, and it seems the swamp we have always with us. Oh, by the way, I mentioned the war on coal. And how Obama done had gone to war with the coal industry, putting hard working men and women out on the streets with his war on coal and the Kenyan EPA, right? I don't want to break any hearts or anything, but it's a lie. You know that. What's funny, though, is that even the coal companies know that. One coal company in particular. Consol Energy, they're the coal company that blew up the mountain about 2 miles from where I live. They've got a great big old mine over in Virginia. The Buchanan Mine. And they laid off 620 workers not too long back. And a representative from Virginia named Morgan Griffith said, it's because of the administration's ongoing war on coal. The Republicans naturally echoed that. GOP in Virginia saying, the Environmental Protection Agency has followed through with regulations to shut down a mine. Because there's a war on coal. There's only one problem. There isn't a war on coal. And guess what? As of a press release last week, Consol Energy expects to produce 13.4 to 13.8 million tons during the quarter, including 0.6 million tons at the Buchanan mine, which is expected to restart on the week of November 5th. But they're not retracting their war on coal bullshit. Because they lie. And lying is what liars do best. War on coal. Fascinating story out of the Washington Post.
Countries like China, Iran, the Sudan, but the privateers, you know, the profiteers are out there saying, oh yeah, sell us your stuff. look at Florida, who, you know, they're saying maybe leading the way. They've just wrapped up a bunch of hearings. They want to privatize, you know, a number of their operations. Ohio, we talked about last week, sold one of them for $73. Only going to take about two and a half years for those people to make their money back. What's really ironic, though, and it's one of those things that kind of frustrates me, is, you know, most of the time the people who buy the prisons or buy our state assets, our money, and they get to take not only the money and the asset, but we end up paying them in the long run the thing back. So for them, it's a win-win. Us, well, lose-lose. But here again, you know.
And it's still expensive. Then there's Marie Shimarik, a director at Standard & Poor's. She follows the mining industry. She says, "We've been relatively negative on Central Appalachia for quite some time because it's an expensive area to mine. It's been mined out and has thinning coal seams." Well, then it's not getting any thinner. It's just they've gotten all the thick stuff. And so when they blow up enough mountains to constitute the entire area of the state of Delaware, because they're trying to get at seams of coal that are sometimes 6 inches thick. It's been mined out and it has thinning coal seams. We've been mining there forever. She continued, "Central Appalachia is being squeezed the most. At natural gas prices today, the coal in a lot of those mines is not really competitive. And you're seeing a lot of the utilities in that area have moved to natural gas." But then, even where the coal is pretty easy to get at, she dropped a bit of a, I hate to say it, but a bombshell. "Their 200 years supply of coal at today's prices? Probably not, but there is a lot." That whole "a lot" part is a relative phrase. There's not a lot, there's enough. There is enough coal in the ground in Central Appalachia, in the Illinois Basin, in the Powder River Basin, to make sure that we render this planet inhospitable, intolerant to human life. Which I guess is the other side of the coin. Let's say you're able to build that community that eats a lot of antioxidant-bearing greens, and you drink tea of an evening sweetened with honey from your local bees, the ones that survive, and that provides a boatload of cancer-preventing agents. And you dance like something out of Zorba the Greek. And you laugh into your 90s.
Item, no. You pay a gallon tax. So if you go in, you buy that bottle of Dom Perignon, you're going to pay a gallon tax. But if you go in there and you buy that glass of wine, you're going to pay. Much higher tax. So explain to me how it's a $100 bottle of wine gets a tax break. And the poor wine who's going to go in there and get his box of Ripple, he's going to get screwed. That seems to be the thing. And here's the thing with this gallon tax. The years down the road, 10, 15 years down the road, as inflation away, inflation eats away at this tax, because the price will go, it goes up with the price. So if a bottle of wine goes for bucks, the tax goes up. 6% of 10 bucks, 6% of 20 bucks. There's your difference. Gallon tax, this gallonage tax, doesn't do that. You're taxed on the gallonage. I mean, it's amazing. Amazing scheme. And I'm sure Grover Norquist gave it the thumbs up. You know, they all the Republicans took their little pledge. Can't increase taxes. So what they've done? Gallonage tax. Beautiful thing. But HB 11 is coming, Jake, and it'll be interesting to see where this goes, because a lot of the language people are talking about, oh, well, you know, it's been sold well. Close the budget gap, all of this stuff. It ain't. You're not going to get the money per license to do any of that. What you're going to end up with is a system that's trolled, because, you know,
yep.
I worry about that. And call me a hypocrite. I'm okay with that. In this scenario, I am a hypocrite. I don't want my kids to have the same access that I had, period.
Well, we talked about negatives wasn't happening in other states when he went from a controlled system to a privatized system. Alcohol consumption among underage drinkers went up. Alcohol consumption among those who break the law, alcohol consumption with drunk drivers. There is a price to be paid, and unfortunately, this time we didn't see those advocates like the Mad Mothers. We didn't see them, who were powerful and very effective the last time they tried to privatize. We didn't see that. But then when you look at the numbers and you look how they're constructing it, you can only come to the conclusion that there is no way that you are not going to have an increase in crime involving alcohol. It's just a given. And that's something that apparently those who back privatization are willing to accept.
Got an email during the break. Says William writes, Rick, private liquor stores were always a favorite of armed robbers. And, you know, there's some truth to that. I mean, how many of our state stores have been robbed? How many times you see somebody walk in and rob one of the state stores? It's not something you see often. But you go to some cities like D.C. or you go to cities like Cleveland, that kind of stuff happens more often than it should. And I don't want to see. Well, there's a liquor store on every corner. Would you like some chips? I got liquor over here. Would you like some T-shirts? We got some liquor. Would you like a hoagie? Yeah, we got some liquor. Where everything is, now it's right there. It's an impulse buy. Yeah, I'm feeling kind of down today. Let me drown my Sar Fifth. A Jack of Fifth.
Well, another Jack of Fifth. You know, another issue we have, well, hasn't really been vetted. When you have the control system, you have people who's one and only job is to monitor the amount of alcohol so that the state gets the proper amount of tax. Are we going to have that with a privatized? Serious doubts about that.
We're going to pay that extra 1% away for people paying their taxes on time.
Not to mention the about 4,500 good paying jobs you're gonna throw away.
This is robbery playing. Plain and simple. Nothing more than this. This is handing for-profit interest anything from it. It's our diamond.
They would have to contribute. Sure did it. I've been pondering these ideas for weeks. These days, I have no inclination to live till my 90s. Oh, goddess, deliver me, Kate says. The planet is toast, our center isn't going to hold, and I am so glad I'm old. And yet there are those of us who would like to be around, I guess, for what the fireworks professionals, you know, the guys who set off, like the Grouchies. Is that their name, the Grouchies? The really big, like over New York Harbor. That last one where everything goes up. Boom, 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 boom. It's called the finale rack.
Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a suit, diving underwater to repair a bridge. Or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do?
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrington. For more than 100...
technology and techniques. Now, I'm not trying to be genderist in this, but I'll go say, you know, there are probably some women within the reach of my voice right now who really could sit down and teach a 10-year-old girl or boy how to make a quilt that would help them survive a cold and brutal winter. There are some men out there within the sound of my voice who could probably teach a little boy or a little girl how to go hunt food in the forest. But we don't have enough forest or enough animals in it to feed us all. There are people of either gender who could say, you can eat this, don't eat that. And stay away from the mushrooms until you're damn sure you're an expert. What does that look like? What does that feel like? What are the things that, what are the elements of a community that you would want to have? And what would you get rid of? I'm spoiled. I still want the internet. I don't want it because, you know, I need to go and feed my angry birds or anything. I'm an information freak. I like to know
Morgan Stanley there.
That people don't misbehave, not because they have some god-awful prison sentence hanging over their heads, but because they don't want to shame their community. And because everybody knows everybody else's business. And anytime you've ever been to a little community festival, you know, we do one of those, you know, once a year, like Bridge Day last week. 100,000 of your closest neighbors, right? You can get a little tiny sense of it. I sensed it in Germany at that Pentecost festival with the bad 90s disco thumping into the night. On the island, the article notes, although unemployment is high, perhaps as high as 40%, most everyone has access to a family garden and livestock. People who work might have several jobs. Someone involved in tourism, for example, might also be a painter or an electrician or have a store. People are fine here because we are very self-sufficient, one individual said. We may not have money for luxuries, but we will have food on the table and still have fun with family and friends. We may not be in a hurry to get work done during the day, so we work into the night. At the end of the day, we don't go home to sit on the couch. Well, by God, that's intolerable. They've got to be up at 6, out the door at 7, on the road until 8, walking...
One woman said, do you know there's no word in Greek for privacy? When everyone knows everyone else's business, you get a feeling of connection and security. The lack of privacy is actually good because it puts a check on people who don't want to be caught or who do something to embarrass their family. If your kids misbehave, your neighbor has no problem disciplining them. There's less crime not because of good policing, but because of the risk of shaming the family. You asked me about food, and yes, we do eat better here than in America. But it's more than about how we eat. Even if it's your lunch break from work, you relax and enjoy your meal. You enjoy the company of whoever you're with. Food here is always enjoyed in combination with conversation. Well, as long as it doesn't take more than 15 minutes and you're back at your workstation, and not a second later, there is profit to be made here, don't you know? Andy writing in says, it's an assault, an absolute assault on working people in this country. The plutocrats are snuffing us out. Our food, water, politics, air, and our society are killing us. A wonderful feudal world in the USA. Just a thought, says Andy. Oh, I think it's more than a thought, Andy. I think it's a reality. Feudalism is not necessarily defined by mud and badly woven textiles.
Dennis, there's some lovely filth down here.
It is defined by the way that human beings are treated by other human beings. Jack in Shreveport said, you know, that's why those CEO bastards always live in some other town. Yeah, they have community. The 1%, by God, do have community. They have bridge clubs and soirees down at the yacht basin. And they have two-hour lunches. And they enjoy the conversation of whomever they're with. But that is something to which we proles are damned well not entitled. News Ninja Gene, on the subject of food, says, actually, given my disability, I'm seriously thinking about bugs. Hopefully slow ones. That is, I think, to say the least, News Ninja Gene's wry sense of humor. Slow bugs.
Soylent Green Gene.
Don't say green gene. Soylent Green is people.
I love you all.
That's Agnes, and she does.
Yes, and we enjoy conversation. You don't have to be 1% to enjoy conversation.
No, that's not what I was saying, dear.
I know, but I just came back to poke you a little
They
bit.
Have their conversations. They have their leisure lifestyle. Leisure is too good for us. We are made to eat and excrete and die.
But we don't have.
And when you have some, and when you have something like if when you have a, when you have a paradigm expressed like Icaria, well, make no mistake. Like I said, on the one hand, you'll have somebody out there hustling. Call 800 Icaria. Or a tourism industry will spring up, and then everybody on the island will be 100 years old. That's what happened in Georgia. They thought that they had identified a culture of centenarians, and then it turned out, no, not so much. Because suddenly money was coming into the community based on people. Hey, Eunice, let's go have some old people tourism and go and look at the 100-year-olds in Georgia. So naturally, everybody who had a couple of wrinkles on their face became 100 years old. See how it works? I read this article and I almost grieved for that island. Because the article's in the New York Times. Which means the 21st century equivalent of the serpent in the garden will soon be there. And it won't be working stiff proles like us. It'll be the 1%. Oh, Muffy, do let's take a plane over to Athens and then perhaps the ferry across to Ikaria. And we can live for a week like those wretched people do, and maybe it'll keep us from getting colon rectal cancer. See how it works? Yeah, I figured. Jesus, a two-hour filibuster. This is unusual. Well, it can be a three-hour filibuster, too. So we'll take a little break and come back. By the way, and I don't know to what extent the absence of the toll-free number is keeping the lights from lighting up. Didn't seem to be a problem last night. But if you want to get in on the conversation, you now have an hour in which to do it. I hate it when I sit here and say, oh, this is conversation radio, and then I filibuster for 3 hours. Oh, I got enough material in front of me to do five. But like I said, I admit, sick of it. At least for tonight, I'm sick of
it. Sirs, who analyze remedy
when the only people who need to be talking about what rape is and isn't are people who have experienced rape. I got one here that arrived too late for prayer meeting Wednesday. The story of Father Rolando Garcia. He's been placed on leave. That's what Holy Mother Church does when you actually ought to be indicted. Because the Archdiocese of Miami just learned today that Father Rolando Garcia, who intercedes with God Almighty and makes the miracle of the Mass happen, Father Rolando Garcia apparently, allegedly, engaged in oral sex and what is referred to as sodomy with a runaway boy. Jesus. At a press conference this past Tuesday, Tony Simmons recalled that Garcia, Father Garcia, began abusing him in 1994 at the Church of the Little Flower in Hollywood, Florida. Simmons said the Catholic priest first offered him food and counseling, you know, because he was a runaway. Over time, then, Father Garcia, man of God, plied him with movies, concerts, booze, and porn. And eventually, it led to what is referred to as oral sex and sodomy. He couldn't speak up because he lived and worked as a painter at the church, which is the perfect situation in which the rape victim remains economically dependent upon the rapist. Mr. Simmons joined the military in 2003, and even then Father Garcia stayed in touch with him. Simmons said he changed his mind about coming forward when Garcia, Father Garcia, laughed while telling him that others had also accused him of pedophilia. The lawyer who represents Mr. Simmons has sued three times, has sued Garcia three times in the past 7 years. Two of them were settled out of court. And yet he returned to the pulpit to say magic words over a glass of, over a cup of bad wine. And for all we know, continue to prey upon little boys. Garcia was presently at St. Agatha Catholic Church. The communications office of the Archdiocese said, "The Archdiocese will offer counseling to the alleged victim and conduct an investigation following procedures outlined in Protecting God's Children." I didn't know there was a part of the Florida Code called Protecting God's Children. Well, that's mainly because there isn't. F the law, we're the church. We sell tickets out of hell and into heaven. Jesus Christ. So, yeah, little breaks in order. We'll take it. I'm Bob Kincaid. This is The Horn. 304-658-3333 is the number. Jump in if you want.
Give to me my time and money. Give to me my milk and honey. Give to me my self-respect. Golden chains around my neck. Give to me my supermodel. Corporate jet and champagne bottle. Get me out there on the town. Let me spread my wealth around. I could learn to love this life I lead. Just don't take away the things I need. I feel rosy in a pink, so just don't make me stop and think. All those dark thoughts in my head seem like better left unsaid. Give it to me. Give it to me. Give it to me. Give to me my latest fashion. Make my lover burn with passion. Give to me my charm and wit. Keep my body young and fit. Give to me my haute couture. Give the world a cancer cure. Serve my breakfast al fresco. Let the wine and liquor flow. I can search for truth some other time. But right now I just wanna get what's mine. The gangsters rule the streets while teachers try to make ends meet. I despise all bleeding hearts. I don't fit the Nazi art. Give it to me. Give it to me. Give it to me. Right now.
I don't understand what it is you're trying to sell me, or what it is you're trying to tell me. Trying to get me to show some compassion. Man, that's so out of fashion.
Give to me my Aspen winner. Sorry about the World Trade Center. I can't help the ones in need. I got my own mouth to feed. Give to me my Playboy channel. Some killer weed and sheets of flannel. Lay me down upon my bed with pleasant dreams to fill my. Give it to me.
Tonight's final hour of Head On begins now. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Bob.
8 minutes past the hour. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid, Thorn in the Side Thursday. And let us goes straightway to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob. How are you?
I'm well.
Well, you know, nobody's been calling in, so I thought I'd give a call. I guess we're getting down to, pretty close to the election. But forget the election, the Murdoch thing and all that, Murdoch or whatever you call his name. But you know, it's good to see you get through its 7th birthday. I was happy to see that.
Thank you very kindly. I'm sorry. I'm struggling. Give me a name, please.
Thomas.
Oh, Thomas. I'm sorry. I didn't recognize you.
Well, that's okay. I haven't called.
You don't call very often, so I don't have you imprinted yet.
No. Well, that's good.
Yeah. That's my apologies, though. Well, thanks. We're now working on year 8, and that's pretty cool.
Yeah. I was glad about the little report you gave on the guy from Greek islands or something like that.
It's a Greek island, Ikaria.
Yeah, I saw your tweet, and every once in a while I just have it logged in my mind, www.twitter.com. Bob. Kincaid, and I'll pull it up for once in a while. I saw that today, and I went and read it. It's a touching story.
Yeah, it is. I mean, and especially when he talked at the very end, when he says he went back to ask the doctors why he survived, but he couldn't ask them because they were all dead.
Mm-hmm. It was kind of apropos because today I got my little health plan for next year from the company. I got to work through that this weekend somehow. I think I'm going to be out a couple $100 a month come next year, but, you know, I'll deal with it. At least I have a job where, you know, I have some income to take care of it. And, you know, it's more than I can, than you can say, which is,
Well, yeah, and I hope Thomas people.
That a couple of Democratic senators are trying to tighten up in the foreseeable future.
I wonder if that was just an oversight in the GI Bill, figuring that someone wouldn't notice heavily.
It's a very arcane process.
Now, her paycheck, $75. Now, I don't know what the pay cycle she has, but $75.
Well, and I don't want to be a smartass and say something like, you know, don't spend it all in one place. But Thomas, when you look at something like that in the light of, say, that story we had out of Pennsylvania that John Fox sent me last night, that shows that literally workers' own state tax withholdings could be paid to their employers.
Yeah, you know, Rick's been on that big time forever.
Yeah.
You know, they're doing this little scheme, but what they're doing is they're taking the payroll and unemployment and all that and go, hey, employer, just keep the money. Don't send it to us.
Yeah.
And then they tell everybody, we're giving them all this money and funding. Instead of have the funds come into the state and have that budgeted out, well, now they don't. Hey, it's a free ride forever.
Great. Yeah, good, and good for corporate America, I guess.
Yeah. Tug. It's sickening, you know. I did.
What do we call a governmental structure? Not even governmental. What do we call a structure like that, Thomas? When the purpose of government becomes dedicated to what? To becoming a tax farmer for corporations? What I mean, is there a name for that kind of governance? I mean, is it fascism? Is it just plutocracy, oligarchy? I'm not asking this rhetorically. I don't know.
Yeah, it's Russia in the 1990s that Taibbi even talked about. Just they just handed off all the assets off to their chosen few.
Where does it all wind up?
Well, it winds up on our backs. We're the ones going to be carrying the damn load. I don't see anybody else going to be picking up the load, but we're going to be searched, and they'll be happy that we're searched.
And we should be happy we're searched, right?
Well, you know, the beating, morale improved after, after.
Yeah, right. The beatings will continue until morale improves, right?
Yeah. It's like, I keep my mouth shut at work because, they have me employed and that. It's just a matter of time before I have some boss comes telling me how to vote, because I see that's going on throughout these different organizations, going to tell their workers, you ain't going to have a job if you don't vote the way we want you to. And somehow I think they're going to institute some system where, and I even read something earlier this year, where, you know, in a democracy, we need to know how everybody votes. Well, we know what that's about. Know who to punish.
Right. You know, I think I may have mentioned it, Thomas, but I did something really dangerous around here. I put an Obama sign in my yard, our yard.
Yeah, and I mentioned to you an email we did took my grandson up to the bridge today.
Yeah.
We drove up there last weekend. You got a few friends there in Anstead that has them out there too.
Yeah, that's true.
And
well, shucks, you should have sent me a note or something. Well, I mean, it's hard to get her over. Meet me on the bridge. Doesn't exactly work on
the reporting we've done, recent Frontline, Bloomberg Business Week. There's just a whole lot of veterans out there who feel bamboozled, who find themselves in kind of a debt hole, thought they were getting help with their educations and their futures, and now they're kind of up the river without a paddle.
And probably in deep debt along with it. The piece is How Pricey For-Profit Colleges Target Vets. FBI Bill Money. We've got a link at the ricksmithshow.com. Adam Weinstein, I appreciate the time.
Thanks, Rick.
Take a quick break. We are back right after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-RICK.
President Obama. Obama has joined the perky posse of national leaders. Who are urging America about the economic doldrums.
Get in there. But your mountains are beautiful, I gotta say that.
Well, what's left of them.
Yeah, well, I think,
See, if you got out to the middle of the bridge and you looked downriver, you can see sort of a scrubby-looking line. Well, that used to be a mountain, Thomas. That mountain is no longer there.
Yeah, well, they had us on the south side of the bridge.
Right.
So looking down there was,
Well, did you drove by that great big Walmart plaza, right, there in Fayetteville?
No. No, I came down to Anstead.
Oh, okay, so you didn't see that. Well, you at the top where the parking lot begins at the Wally World, you can look off across the road.
and you can see where they're blasting the bejesus out of another set of mountains there. Those are the mountains that they're shipping to India.
All right. Now I have a place, somewhere down along Route 61 there?
Yeah.
All right. So we came down 60, and as far as every map, as far as getting down there, it said go 60. I looked at.
Right.
That's the way we went. And that beautiful resort down there along that river, it was just gorgeous.
Hawk's Nest? Yeah, that used to be known as Marshall's Pillars. Named for Chief Justice John Marshall, who visited the area. But the oldest part of Hawk's Nest is, of course, CCC construction. You can tell from the stonework.
Well, what was good for me was going down and see just what you're trying to protect. And any foreign listener, in your shot or within driving distance, can take a day trip and go just see the majesty of what you're trying to protect. I would encourage them to do that.
Well, thank you, Thomas. It is worth saving.
It is.
These communities are very old. And in some places, they've even blasted away cemeteries with War of 1812 veterans in them. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to let you go. And hopefully more people call in. I always try to call in on your landline there because, it's not going to put a dent in my budget, I don't think. And
well, I appreciate it. And, as soon as I can negotiate a settlement with these people, we'll get the 800 number back. But I'm not going to pay them. I'm not going to pay them for services they never rendered.
Yeah, well, it's like right now it sounds like you're dealing with an extortion one, Brack.
Well, it is, and if I could call up a lawyer buddy and say, why don't you send these guys a nasty gram? I probably would, because they're in breach of their own contract.
Yeah. Well, I wish you luck for you and us, because it's great to have even conversation with people.
Well, thank you, Thomas. I appreciate it. And really, next time you get down this way, give a holler.
I will.
All right.
Good night.
Take care, Thomas. Bye now. I feel really bad I didn't recognize Thomas's voice. But that's Thomas Jug of Punch from the chat room. He's there every month helping us keep this all lit up. Onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob?
Yes.
Hi, this is Harry.
Hey, Harry, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm well, I think.
Quite honestly, I was happy to let you talk for the entire 3 hours, what you were talking about tonight and last
night. I feel very embarrassed when I do that, Harry.
Well, that's actually why I called. I figured maybe I didn't know how many people were going to call.
I feel like I'm taking up somebody else's time.
Oh, no. Well, you're also, as you said, I agree with this, you are giving voice to things that should be given voice to, and I actually decided to call in and to try to maybe add on or augment what you were been talking about, not only tonight but last night. But before I do that, I wanted to congratulate you on your anniversary the other night. As and some of your Horn listeners know, I'm a relatively recent convert. And but I, in the past 4 or 5 months, I guess, and I have to tell, I also tell this to all the other members of the Horn family, I've been telling people here, I live in Washington, D.C., that I tell anybody who listens and my friends that your program is, in my opinion, the most, frankly, the most profound sort of cultural social program on any kind of radio today, whether internet or terrestrial. And I really mean that. I'm not a person who says things to
No, I can tell when I'm being shined on, and I don't think you're doing that.
No. As I tell people, I'm one of the least competent brown nosers in Washington, D.C., where I live. I mean, among living...
Well, and that can make living in D.C. kind of hard.
Yes, it can. But I sometimes say it as what I'm trying to make sure that people understand that I'm not being hyperbolic or exaggerating or trying to charm them into anything, but that I'm being honest about my feelings and thoughts. So I'm very proud, really, even to be a novice in the, and or a new member of the Horn family, because I appreciate your program so much, and I do understand, and I know this concerns you a little bit, but I do understand that you are, even when you're saying things and being very concerned or being very outraged, that you're really trying to give voice to other people as well, and I deeply appreciate that.
Well, I thank you. I thank you more than you can know, Harry. It's not overt. But by the same token, I don't know how to describe it. It's just that over the course of the years, this effort has become different from when it started. I mean, when we started, we had little ad breaks and everything because we just knew we were going to go to terrestrial radio any minute.
Yeah, yeah. Well, but you know, in a sense, as you have said, you know, this is an experiment on internet radio, and you know, this indeed, I mean, you could be, and I hope you will be, I think you already are, but I also hope you will be seen in the future as a pioneer in this kind of radio, because in fact people can talk about things and say things here that, as you have noted many times, maybe couldn't be said on terrestrial radio, either because of FCC regulations or even just because of the nature of broadcasting and the need for commercials, et cetera. And certainly I have listened to daytime, so-called progressive hosts who are constantly, cutting off their callers after 30 seconds. And I know you've said that this is the thing you did not want to do.
No.
And in fact, if anything, you wanted to lengthen your conversations and have in-depth conversations, and I think you have succeeded at that. And I'm and looking at the clock, trying not to take up too much more of your time when I say that, but I think that is, what you have done, and I think you have succeeded at it admirably.
Well, I do. I appreciate it. And but none of this. If I was just sitting here 3 hours a night filibustering, some people can get some enjoyment out of it, and the 3 hour filibuster after I came back from Europe, I didn't mind doing because there was a lot of story to get out.
Yeah.
But to do it, I mean, what we're talking about here is a sincere offering, Harry, because there is no, and I'm trying not to swear, but there's no dialogue in this country. There is no community conversation.
Right. Well, this is why, as I said, I've told everyone I know that this is, your program, that I rarely miss it, because it's really the most profound thing, kind of broadcasting that I have found in this country or really anywhere.
I remember the time, and you never know where exactly the roots are coming from. But I remember being a little boy, and I think I've said in the past, the first time I ever heard a man screaming in anger was not my father.
Mm-hmm.
It was the man of God standing in the pulpit at the Baptist church, and he scared me to death.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember later on looking at my mother, who was incredibly devout, and saying, when people have questions, why don't they raise their hands and ask the preacher questions?
Yeah. It's a profound question.
And she said, because that's not done.
Well, children sometimes, ask the most profound things. And, in a way, that's, I grieve for that sometimes, that the curiosity of children, somehow gets extinguished along the way.
And it doesn't just, and again, that's a phrase that keeps coming back into discussion more and more lately, Harry. That's by design, too.
Right. Yeah, well, actually, I would agree with that, and we could talk about that.
I mean, if you have a chance to go over to PrismWV, PRISMWV.org, and catch last Sunday's chat discussion between Professor Keith and Dr. Bill,
mm-hmm.
and their discussion of Plato's analogy of the cave.
Yeah.
and what that means in terms of how we go about the idea of the very, you know, the platonic idea of education, if you will.
Right.
I think you'll find echoes of the same thing.
Oh, sure. And, you know, and I certainly don't want to bore the Horn family with this, but, you know, we could talk about even, you know, contemporary writers and old school of thought about these things, like the school of critical pedagogy and various people, and even people today like Henry Giroux, who is a professor at McMaster University, writes a lot of columns for Truthdig, you know, about, and even before that, I mean, back in the 50s, there was an anthropologist, a very brilliant man named Jules Henry, who wrote about a lot about education and mental health in the U.S., and he used to talk about, you know, the needs of society and how, in fact, society does not want, you know, intelligent students or intelligent adults, because it would have destroyed the society. There was a need to keep people stupid, in a way, he was saying, although he said it much more eloquently than I just did. But if I may, I just wanted to just briefly comment on some of the things you've been talking about the last few nights and just
sure.
Say some things that maybe I hope. I mean, I called because I thought, well, and, you know, as you know, Bob, I discussed with you at least a few times privately the fact that I, you know, I have certainly enough of my own problems to worry about. But I did want to just add some personal observations, because I think the things that you've been talking about are really very serious. First of all, I read the article after your show. I read the whole article about the from the Amherst student, the woman who had been raped.
Yes.
And yes, and I, you know, of course, you were able to sort of, you wanted to, and I think did that very well, you know, hook this up with the whole dialogue of all of these right-wing politicians that don't seem to understand what rape even means, or, you know, and how it affects an individual's life, you know.
I think it extends, I mean, not to break into your idea, yeah. Harry, but I think it extends past that.
Oh, yeah, sure.
I think when you get right down to it, you know, if you took a Richard Murdoch
yeah.
and put him in a chair and duct taped him real good and fired him up with sodium pentothal, you'd find out that he doesn't even believe in the concept of rape, that women are vessels for receiving whatever
yeah.
a man deems via some sort of special relationship with the deity that they should be given.
Right.
And that includes, you know, that includes rapists.
Yeah, and I agree, and that's probably right, and you're right. There's probably, in a sense, a totally different, although incredibly barbaric and, you know, regressive and primitive culture that we're, in a sense, confronting. And I didn't mean in any way to trivialize the, you know, the issue in any way, because and as you rightly said last night, I mean, for any woman that you know or I know or anybody, you know, any woman on the planet, this is very, very, very sick and troubling. But I wanted to tell you also, when I read the article, the other thing that, and of course you've read the whole article, I don't know if other people have as well, but, you know, it points, there's something also terrible about the way that Amherst College as an institution, in a sense, almost let itself remain in that kind of barbaric, regressive culture. And I just wanted to say that, you know, I myself actually almost attended Amherst College. I was accepted there. But that was in an era when Amherst College was all male still.
Right.
And in fact, at that time also, and I think they still do, though, they also had fraternities. And because of my own values and feelings and sensitivities at the time, the one thing I had vowed is that I would not go to a college that was either all male or had fraternities, because at that time I found I was very worried about the kinds of, you know, negative or, you know, harmful, I hate to say this, but harmful behavior that happens when you have fraternities on campus or you have a college which is just, you know, boys.
Absolutely. I mean,
yeah.
And that's so, I mean, I know the history of fraternities because I was in one. In fact, when there were fraternities at Amherst, the fraternity of which I joined in college was on campus and, in fact, gave us Calvin Coolidge.
Yeah,
okay?
right.
And just to mention for a minute, it's how institutions can be perverted. I mean, I brought forward the story.
That's what I said. I didn't want to condemn all fraternities.
No. But I understand. But can you imagine? You know, we had the story about the guy vociferously trying to convince people that he wasn't one of them homos who pours alcohol in his blood.
I mean, truly bizarre, although fascinating. You know.
My own fraternity was founded on May the 1st, 1848.
Yeah.
By a group of six young men, all of whom had been admitted to Masonry.
Yeah.
And they were a debating society. Yeah. And they discussed, and it's 1848, the great questions of the day are blooming all around them. They're sitting in literally a log cabin in Cannonsburg, Pennsylvania, at what was then Jefferson College.
Yeah.
And they were, you know, they were studying Greek and they were studying Latin, you know, the classical liberal arts education of the day.
Yeah.
And they were discussing matters of great import, and they imbued themselves with, frankly, a lot of the same silly crap that that the Mormons went on to imbue themselves with, because they lifted the Masonic ritual, too.
Yeah.
But it was all about honor, and it was about integrity, and it was about decency, and it was about a quest for knowledge. And how you get from that to butt chugging?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you are correct. It is, you know. As I said, I hope no one feels that I'm insulting.
Oh, I don't think they do. And I wasn't trying to defend it. I was trying to add a layer of meaning to it.
Yes. Well, you're absolutely right. And I think the word fraternity, you know, implies, frankly, and particularly when, you know, mostly men went to college, fraternity, you know, does imply something very positive. And, you know, there are certainly people, many people, both private and public figures who, you know, talk fondly about, you know, the fellowship and the positive aspects of, things that happened in their fraternity. And I can think of, you know, people at very different places in life. I can think of the novelist Philip Roth, who, when he was at a small liberal arts college, his fraternity, which was actually sort of the Jewish fraternity, was wonderful. And also the scientist Richard Feynman, who, when he was at MIT, was in a sense he went when he was fairly young, you know, sheltered in a sense by his fraternity. So there are, you know, certainly very positive fraternity, you know, experiences out there. But you're right, it can be perverted. And I guess when I was applying to colleges, which was in the 70s, I was very worried about, at that time, you know, there was a lot of discussion about fraternity problems. And because I had, as I said, and that was actually the only college I applied to that actually had distinct fraternities. So, and the thing is, Amherst, in some ways, has always been and is a very good college. But I didn't go, and it was in fact in part, well, because it had fraternities, and also because it was all men. But when Amherst went co-ed, which was 15, 20 years later, I thought to myself, gee, wouldn't it have been great if I could have gone, you know, to an Amherst that was co-ed? Because I thought that. And I'll say this, I thought it would have humanized it, you know, having both men and women together rather than just an all-male college. And, of course, you know, particularly in the 70s, you know, people began to wonder whether all-male colleges were really...
Well, there's something in a society that throws the word democracy around, Harry, there is something unsettling about an all-anything college.
Exactly, yeah. Although, you know, I know that still there are, you know, and I think, you know, they have a right to say this, there are... very thoughtful women who still believe that perhaps an all-female college, in some cases, is in a sense for women a more a healthier and more accepting environment in which to go to college. So,
well, and you can certainly make that argument out of the Amherst story. I mean, my God, this was
Man, you mean?
No, that you can make the argument that. Well, I don't know if he can or not.
Yeah, I'm not sure you can, but I'm just saying I want to recognize also, I know that there are people who will still say that.
But you know, what I'm getting at is that, you know, this is Amherst. This
right.
is not,
well,
this is not Busted Knuckle State.
Well, this is the thing, you know, and if you read, if anybody read the whole article, they also know that, you know, there, in a sense, there was then further information in the newspaper about the response by the president of this, you know, new co-ed Amherst, and it happens to be a woman. Her name is, I think, Biddy Martin. And what's striking is that it's so odd that the administration, you know, in a sense, found themselves caught, you know, almost unawares by this. I mean, I read her, there was a statement.
Right, because it's almost as if they get up every morning and say, look at us, we're Amherst.
Exactly.
Nothing evil may befall us here.
Yeah, and it was an incredible kind of arrogance. And I mean, I've certainly, you know, encountered arrogance at the college that I did go to.
Right, and lest I be taken as suggesting that there's something wrong with Busted Knuckle State, you can even make an argument that maybe Busted Knuckle State would have had a more proactive response to it because it was not cloaked in such a self-awarding sense of privilege.
Yes, I agree. And in fact, in general, I am aware of the fact that in the last 10 years in particular, that many, many, many colleges and universities have increased their student services in terms of mental health or, you know, sexual violence, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, they've expanded their, you know, counseling centers. They've expanded their, you know, any sort of centers having to do with students in any way, you know, being harmed because of the fact that before that, and that was probably still true in the 70s, maybe even to the 80s, there was not a lot of mental health and other kinds of services available on many university campuses. So, but then there was this push for it. And, you know, and I know that many universities of any, of both kinds, you know, both, I don't know what you, you know, both very privileged institutions, but also, you know, big state universities all sort of tried to expand their programs because they were being told they weren't protecting their students enough in a, you know, in a positive
but,
way.
But, you know, and even, but even under the best of circumstances, Harry.
Yeah.
Something else happens. And that is this. Or not something else happens, but there is something underneath anything that a university can do. And I'm sure you've read, just based on the content of our conversations, you know, you've read the university professors and administrators who bemoan the relative illiteracy of the students they receive from high schools all over the country. You know, they can't read, they can't write, they can't critically analyze text, you know, that kind of stuff.
I haven't. In fact, I just recently read a wonderful book. I don't want to go on about the book, but it's called Doing School, and it's written by a professor at Stanford School of Education. And what it is about, it's actually about a very privileged public high school. And what's so great about the book is that this woman was basically assigned or able to follow around five different students, all of whom were considered by the administration. She let them pick them. Basically the best, you know, students in various ways. And they're not all, you know, just the high-achieving students. They all, you know, there was a...
But, I guess what I'm getting at
yeah.
is this. We not only have kids who are coming ill-prepared academically, to institutions of higher learning. You know, the author of the Amherst student piece refers to the brutality of her upbringing before she got to college. At one point, she talks about backwoods. And
that's right, she does indeed.
And you know, wow, that word is freighted for somebody like me.
Yeah,
what I'm getting at is we've got kids coming into college. Kids, oh Jesus, I'm old. We've got young people coming into college who have not only been academically ill-prepared, but are coming from families that are dysfunction-defined, and it doesn't at all. In fact, it may track oppositely. It's not economically derived. Do you see what I'm? You know,
yes,
you,
I do. Yeah, I will.
I mean, and I know it's easy to do it being this time of year, you know, but think of a young Willard Romney.
Oh, sure. Yeah, well, this is...
pushing a kid, you know, the administration of Cranbrook had not said a word about that young man's hair. He wasn't violating anybody's code of anything.
Well,
but Bishop Romney decided he didn't like it, and drove that young man to the ground and brutalized him.
Oh, absolutely. And I have to tell you that recently a friend of mine who used to be a professor, a very educated person who actually did not grow up in this country, he asked me why it was, though, that the bullying incident, which I believe happened and was documented in April, has not, you know, in a sense, has not been brought up again and again. And I have to agree with them, because to me, that was, to me, the end of my, any respect or any, in a sense, you know, even dignity that I would accord to Bishop Willard, was when I read about that. And I have to say that I myself, you know, when I was maybe quite younger in elementary school, was bullied for a period of time by two very specific people. But, you know, I, and so I know what it is like, and I certainly even in college encountered one person who I'd have to say was sort of a subtle, sublime bully in the way that, you know, sophisticated, this was a very fairly privileged person. And so I'm even aware of the way that a
as it's needed, residents can apply for low-interest loans and grants for caused by Tropical Storm Lee. Also, Lebanon County is offering a $500 grant on first-come, first-served basis to storm victims who meet income guidelines. And provide proof of their losses. Applications can be made starting
is that right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, wouldn't speak
well,
to.
Yeah, well, that's...
I could sit here and tell a story from my freshman year of a privileged young man who was my first roommate.
Yeah.
Who would joyfully tell stories of the hell and damnation that he and his pals had imposed on other young men at some country day school up east.
Yeah, no, it's horrible. And we could even take this farther, I guess, or at least this is the way I would talk about it and say, you know, let's even remove, in a sense, the privilege and just talk about a person who is, you know, 17 years old or 18 years old. You know, maybe his brain is not totally mature, you know, in terms of,
well, in the case of mine, I can say it wasn't even a little bit mature.
Well, I'm talking about the research, which shows that brains, I guess,
26? Nobody should have a driver's license before age 26?
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, that's the age now that they're saying, excuse me, sorry.
That's all right.
That judgment, you know, tends to finally kind of, you know, come together, but, This is a person, and what he does is he decides, you know, I mean, there's something that, to me, just even if it's in the 50s, very sick about a person of that age who, because he detects a certain kind of, I don't know, a sensitivity or, you know, something that to him seems repugnant because it's not hyper-masculine, that he feels the need, you know, to do something, but to do something incredibly active, you know, and cut off someone's hair. I mean, to me that's barbarism. And I'll say it, you know. So
it is.
When I read about I don't care.
And the failure of anybody to discipline that.
Absolutely. And I don't care if it was the 50s and I don't care if he was 17. And yet in our culture, I suppose what my friend was asking me, who's not from the United States, was how is it that we're still so coarse that we, you know, that so many people are willing to say, oh, well, he was 17, or, oh, well, it was the 1950s, you know, and we didn't really know a lot about bullying then. My friend was saying, you know, so what? You know, how can it now, so even if things were, you know, coarser then, why is it now that nobody is now pounding on this and saying this man, you know, was a bully? And, you know, and in fact, we can...
Right, and I saw a photograph the other day, and I'm not sure if it was a reenactment based on, or if it was a real photo. It certainly looked like Willard.
Yeah.
But it was something published over at, I believe, Vanity Fair. And I really couldn't get the gist of it, but apparently there's an account out there of Willard with a fishing pole with a $100 bill on it. You know, transparent line and everything.
Yes, sure.
And it's a photo shot of a sort of bedraggled-looking individual in between buildings reaching for the $100 bill, and either Willard or someone who looks a lot like him getting ready to jerk it back with a big old grin on his face like a fox eating poop out of a wire brush. Mm-hmm. And really? I don't know, Harry. Is this acceptable in the 1% communities? I mean, because we've got the same kind of stories about George W. Bush.
That's right, we do. And we, you know, you mentioned that once several weeks ago.
You know, the brutality with the frogs.
Right. And, you know, this book, Bush on the Couch, which was written by a very, you know, credible psychiatrist, in fact, here in Washington, D.C. you know, I don't know. But see, what struck me was my friend, the one who didn't grow up in the United States, he asked this, I mean, he said this to me, frankly, it was after maybe it was the third debate. He basically said to me, well, now it's clear to me, you know, that, or, you know, Romney's such a bully. And, of course, he was talking about the debate. And we were talking about, you know, also this incident back in, you know, the April, revealing of what Romney did in his prep school. And you realize, in a sense, at least to me, you know, there's a pattern there. And so, you know, then we say, well, why aren't more people even just connecting the dots? You know, I mean, even if you say, okay, it happened once when he was 17, why isn't there more connecting of dots saying, well, didn't he look that same way in that third or second debate? And I'm saying that rhetorically, you know.
Yeah.
And that, I guess, is what bothered me. And I can understand your outrage about, you know, culture and then talking about this island, you know, off of Greece that where a community, you know, is so precious and keeps every, in a sense, you know, brings civility because of it. And I certainly myself, you know, have bemoaned, you know, lack of community. And certainly like a place like D.C., I'm sorry to say that even though it's a small, the residential part of the city is relatively.
Well, you've got a better chance of experiencing community if you go down to Ben's Chili Bowl than you do if you go up into one of those hoity-toity restaurants. You know, say up in, well, up in anywhere.
Right, and we should explain that Ben's Chili Bowl is an icon of an African-American restaurant and place to...
Yeah, I've been in there a handful of times, and every time it's not like I'm known, but every time I walk in there, hey, man, how you doing? What do you want?
Right, and no, indeed, in fact, I think, you know, people talk about the racial divide in D.C., but I'm quite willing, seems to me that part of it really, though, is an attempt to maintain community. And
well, you know, I guess it's just a matter of me. I know my class.
Yeah.
Because I'm more concerned with class than racial divides. And I've had a lot better experiences within my class than outside it there. If that makes any sense at all.
Yes, it does. Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's right. But what I was saying was that, you know, I mean, you do have, unfortunately, people of other ethnic groups or white people, you know, complaining about the so-called hostility of African-Americans in D.C. to them. But I think that part of it really is the African-American community, you know, with their history.
Hanging on for dear life.
Absolutely. Hanging on and also wanting to, whatever they can, you know, keep of community, which for them means people who they, you know, feel comfortable with. Or feel that, you know, can know what they're talking about, they want to hang on to that. Absolutely. Yeah.
Brilliant conversation, Harry. Thank you very much. You got fan mail. Kate just wrote in. Subject line, we don't bore easily. She said, please, Harry, don't presume that whatever informed dialogue you share would ever bore the Horn family. Some nights here are equal to graduate seminars. Others are like overhearing babble in a gas station bathroom. And everything in between. It is never boring here. That's why we keep sending in our dimes and nickels to keep the mic hot. We never know what's going to happen next. Welcome to the family, dysfunctional as it may seem sometimes.
Well, I know Kate is a real veteran of this show, and I take that as a high compliment. I'm quite honored. But, yeah, if you have other callers, I do want to let you go. But I just did want to, in a sense, honor you and also say that I can – well, understand your outrage about all these different recent issues. I think it's a very scary time in our culture, and it is frankly very comforting to me to frankly hear you talk about it, because then I feel that I'm not so alone in my terror. And I'm sure, I suspect.
Yeah, the one thing that scares me, Harry, is that anyone would perceive, and because, and I think it's more a function of the way I judge myself, because that judgment is ongoing and constant. You know, I've joked about the nights when you get done with the show and you go, woohoo, that's one for the ages.
Right.
And the other nights when you just curl up in a fetal ball in the corner and suck your thumb. I joke about that, but there's an element of truth to it. And, you know, I don't, we talk about community and we talk about, you know, family and conversation and dialogue. And I don't ever want to be one of those people who says, you know, I've got mine screwed too. And I've never experienced anybody in the Horn family like that. And I guess the broader question is, and we go back and forth. I know I do. I despair of the American people quite routinely. You know, that 7% of America who is absolutely convinced that Lee Harvey Oswald shot John Kennedy. I mean, that Lee Harvey Oswald shot Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah, right.
You know, what do you do? But then, you know, there's so much decency and there's so much kind concern. And there's real seeking that takes place here. And I just wonder why it can't extend.
Well, you may be, you know, you may end up being the person that we look back on and say, well, Bob Kincaid did that. He helped to extend it. You know, as I said, you may, you know, indeed be a pioneer, something that really will become something, you know, very fruitful and very positive. Because I know that you are pained, and certainly I am pained about, you know, these, what I consider to be quite dark times. But, you know, as I said, I try to make sure that I listen to your show, you know, every night if I can, because it's like a little, you know, it's like that little lamp or that little small fire in the woods that I, you know, makes me feel just a little bit better.
Well, I thank you. I thank you, Harry. And you have yourself a wonderful evening.
Yeah, I'll let you go. Thank you.
Take care. Bye now. Calling from D.C., that is our buddy Harry. And from one conversation to the next, I think Kate said it better than anybody ever has. Sometimes it's like a graduate seminar, and sometimes it's like overhearing babble in a gas station bathroom. And it strikes me that it's all worthwhile. I hope I didn't put anybody off with, you know, 2 hours of filibobster tonight. I was just really moved by that article, you know, beyond the, you know, how do I live to be 104? The question of, you know, how we enjoy whatever time is here. By the way, a follow-up from Kate. She said, by the way, Bob, there are women out here who could teach a youngster how to build a cabin, how to tear down a Chevy engine, how to put up a garden, and how to saddle break a giddy pony. It's all about the leather tool pouches and nice-fitting jeans. And I know she's right. And I was trying not to get myself in trouble. There are guys who can teach people to quilt. I, for one, was taught to needlepoint because my sister was having to teach it to other students. So I learned to needlepoint. And she's an art teacher, and she had to teach students how to do batik. Back in the 70s, and I learned how to do batik, and I learned how to make candles. I'm not completely dualist. I just can't rebuild that goddamn Chevy engine. But Kate closes saying, Mad Max times are right over the hill. Be nice to your neighbors. Hear, hear. Aw, damn, it's time to get out of here. Well, this is one of those where does the time go moments. Thanks to all of you. My God, that's the biggest spider I've seen in years. Crawling right across the studio wall. I'm going to, please, stay put, would you? I'll take you outside. The hunting's much better. My daughters would scream. Well, for that matter, so would my son. Okay, I got to deal with this. Just stay put, please. Thanks, everybody, for everything that you do to make all this happen. Thank you for helping us reach our fundraising goal for the month of October and beating the Swede. Pursuant to your direction of last month, we will continue to try to raise money. Pursuant to what Tom said in his email, we'll try to build that cushion. Because there's lots of stuff needs doing. And we would actually like to catch up before we even start thinking about getting ahead. I asked you to stay put. Thanks to all the all-volunteer crew who keeps all of this rolling along. Thanks to our chat room moderators, Lottie and Sparky. Thanks to our news ninjas, Dean and Susan. Thanks to Agnes. Thanks to our blogger, Texas Betsy. Thanks to John Fox. And thanks to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. He'll get the podcasting up just as quick as the machine gets fixed. Thanks, of course, go out to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and